the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest this week is Lowell Smith, who is president of Inspira. He'll be discussing the potential pitfalls in SEP IRA employer design and administration, as well as offering a comparison between simple and SEP IRAs for businesses looking to establish them for employee participants. Now, what we're going to do on today's show is to review major decisions that most individuals face during their lifetime. You have critical decisions all during the course of your life that impact your financial well-being. And what we would like to do is share the lessons learned from lifetime financial planning. And here's the big part. We want to avoid what could become really costly mistakes. Maybe that's the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is knowing facts, but wisdom is applying the experience you've had in using those facts. And there's a radical difference between the two. Most important thing you can do is learn from the mistakes of others and avoid them. Don't drive into the same potholes. So that's what you want to do. Avoid costly mistakes. It doesn't matter whether you're a young couple in your 20s or your 30s starting out, whether you're a growing family, say, for example. I know we've got stereotypes here, but this is a lot of people. In your mid-40s and your 50s, maybe you're heading into retirement or in retirement. Today, we want to look at the generational gap between each decade of your life and hopefully avoid the pitfalls that people run into along the way. The real disgusting part of life is that as you get older, it's like raising kids, Jim. You know, as soon as you get really good at raising the kids, they're gone. I mean, this is worthless, you know? So I guess that's why we have grandkids, right? So that's why we want to avoid the pitfalls that you encountered every decade along your life to help you achieve financial success and a good retirement. So let's begin with an overall experience. We're going to your experience you'd like to share or something like that?
Well, you know, the one thing that really strikes me, I've been doing planning now for over three decades, and mistakes become more costly, John, the older you get. I mean, obviously, let's say an individual or a couple in their 20s and 30s, let's say they have $10,000 of net worth. They can afford to make a mistake. You can make a bad investment because you still have 30 years of your working career ahead of you to overcome or make up for that mistake. You take a couple in their 40s, maybe by now they've got a couple hundred thousand they've saved up through, let's say, various pension, IRA, or 401k programs, they can afford to go through a bear market. Because if you're in your 40s, you're not going to retire for another 20, 25 years. You can go through a bear market the last 2 years, and then the recovery that comes afterwards. You take a couple in their 50s. They have maybe 500,000 of accumulated assets. You know what? A major bear market is going to impact them and have a more meaningful outcome on what happens in their retirement, because they're only maybe 10 years away from retirement. And also, you know, you think about couples in their 60s, they could have a $500,000 or $1 million. It becomes very critical. They can make some mistakes and never recover because maybe they've stopped work, they've retired. And for almost three decades, John, we have had these bull markets. You think of the 80s and 90s. In the 80s, you didn't even have to go into stocks. You got double-digit returns at the bank, free toasters. You know, I can remember the 80s when I first got in the business. We were getting over 9% on tax-free bonds, 14% on government Ginnie Mae's, treasuries in the 12 and 13% range. I can remember in the 91 recession when we went into zero coupon bonds at over 10.5%, the returns that we got from those bonds were incredible. And then, of course, the 90s, gosh, you didn't even have to save. The stock market went up 15, 20% a year, and that's what a lot of people did. They stopped saving. They made that mistake. You take a look at the last decade. Well, we did have a bear market with the tech crash, but then what happened? We came out of it. Commodities did well, emerging market stocks, real estate, and the stock market itself. The stock market got back up to 1,500 before we went into a downturn. So you didn't have to do a lot of things, and if you made mistakes, the market returns sort of helped you out.
So what you're saying is if you look at the 80s or the first part of the new millennium here in the first decade, market returns covered up a lot of mistakes. But today, now this is different. Things keep changing. Today we're in an era of financial repression, low interest rates, and you can't rely on what we had back then, a raging bull market with high return rates constantly going up. That covered up most of the mistakes that you might have made during that time. Now, as we talk so often here, in order to make the right decision, having a plan can help make better lifetime decisions. So let's look at a young couple. Let's take this example. Starting out, what are the key decisions that they need to make during that time, during their startup, and what costly mistakes can they avoid at that stage in their lives?
You know, probably the biggest problem that you have when you're a young couple starting out is prioritizing your goals. I mean, let's say you take a couple that first gets married. In many cases today, we're seeing that couple bring a lot of student loans into the marriage starting out. They may have goals, for example, paying off student loans, saving up enough money for a down payment on a home. They start a family with kids. But the biggest mistake, I think, is to ignore putting some dollars aside at retirement. Now remember, let's say you're 25 and you're starting out. You've got 40 years away before you're going to retire. And to put money aside is real easy because you don't have to put that much money aside in your early years because that money's going to compound over a longer period of time. Let me illustrate this. Let's assume that at retirement, you wanted to have $1 million. Now, let's look at some returns of, let's say, a 10% return over 40 years, which is not unrealistic, or let's say an 8%. Here's the thing, John. To reach those numbers of $1 million over a 40-year period, you only have to put away $158 a month at a 10% return, $286 at an 8% return. Now, some of you might say, okay, 158, you know, gosh, we barely make our budget each month, but let's take that number. Let's say you're working for an employer, and we see this today, where the employer will match 100% of your contribution, let's say on the first 3% of your salary or 6%. I've seen it as high as 6% in many of the big companies. So let's assume that they're going to match dollar for dollar. So if we take that $158, divide it in two, because if you put in $79, the employer will match you dollar for dollar. They will put $79 in. Now, let's also take the tax savings. On the $79 that you put in, you're going to save, assuming a 35% tax bracket, you're going to save $28 in actual income and state taxes. So of the $158, really, you're only putting out of pocket $51 a month because your employer is going to match the $79 you put. So you put in $79, the employer matches it with $79, and then you save $28 on income taxes, so your net out-of-pocket expense is $51. You would only have to put away $51 a month over a 40-year period to have $1 million. And an 8% return, assuming the same assumptions, the employer matches your contribution and tax savings, it's $93 a month. So how many young couples, John, can't afford to put away $51 or $93 a month to reach their retirement goals? In the end, they become a millionaire. There is no magic to this. It is time and the magic of compounding over a 40-year period. It's what made Warren Buffett the second richest man in the world.
Okay, well, it seems like this is very easy and doable. I mean, you don't think that the millionaire concept has really been well explained here, because if you take employer contributions and tax savings and other planning, it's very, very doable. Why do you think that mistakes happen with the majority of young people? Although I have an idea, Jim, because when they start out, $1 million looks like a pretty big thing. And you go, well, I can't match that on my salary, so why try?
I think, John, a lot of it is lack of education. I mean, you take a lot of people that go to college, they teach you how to earn a living, but they don't teach you how to manage your money that you will make over your lifetime. So a lot of it is a lack of education. Explain the concept of compound interest over a period of time. The other thing, too, is I think with young couples, they have many goals, they wants and needs. and they don't prioritize them. Most couples, I think, can afford this $50 or $90, depending on what your assumption is made. So the combination, I think, of lack of education, the inability of prioritizing goals, I mean, you know, let's face it, at age 25, the furthest thing from your mind is probably retirement 40 years from now. You're thinking of, gosh, buying your first house, paying off your student loans, starting a family, various other financial goals, your first family vacation, anything but retirement because it is so far out in the distance. And this is the mistake that's made because it takes very, very little money to put aside when you're that young age, and that's the key concept. I mean, if you put aside the $53 at age 25, you don't need to be putting more than that to get your million-dollar goal when you're in your 40s or 50s, because that money would have been compounding from age 25. You're going to have a lot of money by the time you get that age, and we're going to demonstrate that in a case study later on. With the family who this is the third generation of planning that we've done with this family. We started out with grandfather, dad, and now we're working with the kids. And there is no magic to this. But John, I would say the inability to prioritize the goals, and then I think a lack of education. Because I think if you explain to most couples, hey, $50 a month or $55 or $90 a month, that's doable. I mean, just forgo one dinner out or one weekend out and you can afford that.
So what you're saying here is that failure to plan and to prioritize is a major mistake. I mean, let's give an example here. If you are on a ship or a plane and you're a degree off your bearing, what you're supposed to be, well, when you start out, if you discover your error, it's very easy to correct. However, when you get 1,000, 2,000 miles away from where you started out, the error is pretty great and getting back on course is really difficult. Let's show this for people. Let's do some numbers by decade, because the error increases by decade and the difficulty that you're trying to achieve increases by decade. So share those numbers with the listeners because it drives home the point.
Well, as I mentioned, if you start out at age 25 with employer contributions and tax savings, you'd have to put aside a little over $50 a month to get $1 million by the time you retire 40 years later. Let's go forward 10 years later, age 35. The $51 number jumps to about almost $150. So you're now having to put aside three times the amount. Fast forward to age 45, 20 years later, and the $50 number jumps to almost $428 a month. And here's where it gets scary. At age 55, now you're only 10 years away from retirement. That number, John, jumps to almost $1,600 a month. So you can see the effect of compounding over time. Just starting out at age 25, it's $50. Waiting 10 years, it goes up threefold to $150. So you see the impact. So what you're seeing here, it becomes very doable if you start out early, especially at age 25 when you got 40 years ahead of you, because it becomes almost impossible to reach those numbers if you start out at age 55 or 45. It becomes harder and harder. Time and interest, there's no magic. It works. It's been working for ages. And the real lesson here is the earlier you start, the better off you're going to be, and the less expense it'll cost you to reach that retirement goal.
Okay, let's move on to the 30s and 40s years. Now, I'm talking about personal lives, not the 1930s and 1940s. By this time, this is theory. You probably have a house, your family's underway, and at least somewhat established in a career. Although, you know, frankly, Jim, people make career changes. It seems to be more and more common. Your earnings are higher. Here we are. Now, you know, there's an expression in flying. I always use these nautical terms and aeronautical terms. Runway behind you is useless concrete. Okay.
Especially when you're airborne.
Especially when you're airborne, you know, or taking off. You only have what's in front of you. What's behind is worthless. Right now you've gone through your 20s. You're now in your 30s and 40s, and you can still rationalize to yourself, well, you know, retirement's a ways off. What are the mistakes that they make now at this point, even though earnings are higher and you could conceivably catch up? Common problems, common mistakes.
I think probably the biggest one when you get into your late 30s and 40s is, John, probably overspending. At this point, you're probably further into your career. You know, you're making good money. Your family has expanded. You know, it's nice. Okay, we're making big bucks. Let's get the bigger home. You're looking at nicer cars, luxuries, vacations. You know, I see this over and over again. Many couples spend too much and they save very little. And the temptation is with saving with dollars. And we saw this in the 90s. It was like, why do I need to save? The stock market's going up 15 to 20% a year. I don't need to save. And we certainly saw that in the 90s as the stock market went up double digits a year, the savings rate in this country almost got, well, it did come down to zero. So there's this tendency to spend more and ignore the big expenses that are going to hit you in the latter part of the 40s and 50s. And I'm talking about your kids' college education, weddings. They both come at a time when you really need to be socking away as much money as you can for retirement. Because in your 50s, you know, you're only maybe 10 years away from retirement, or maybe 12, 15 years away. And all of a sudden now you have a couple kids, you're hit with college expenses. If you have girls, you're hit with weddings. And so that takes away money that would normally be put aside. I've seen people stop their 401k contributions because they're getting hit with, you know, expenses for weddings or college. And this can lead to, John, and many cases, financial difficulties that put a strain on marriage. So the mistakes made here is that there's this tendency to overspend. And then I would say probably the other one is bad investment choices.
Okay, let's expand on that one, because quite often you talk about risky investments, people doing day trading, following hot tips, or dumping everything into one area rather than diversifying. There's really a list of bad choices that could be present at this stage.
Well, when you think about your 30s and 40s, this is the period in life where you can afford to take some risk. And it's also that period of time that you want to go for growth. And you should be primarily invested in things that go up. I don't care if it's rental real estate or stocks, because you can afford to ride out a bear market. And the illustration, we used to teach this when we first got into financial planning. It's a concept I'm sure our listeners are familiar with. It's called dollar cost averaging. That's what you're doing if you're putting money each month out of your paycheck into a 401k program. Look at it this way. You are buying shares each month. In a bear market, as we had in 2007 and between 2007 and 2009, had you kept putting money into the market each month, every dollar you put in would have bought more shares because the price of shares were going down because the stock market was going down. But that's what you're doing. You're dollar cost averaging. And every month that stocks went down, the dollars you put in bought more shares because the dollars purchased more because the value of those shares were going down. Now, after 2009, we've been in 6 years in a bull market. Think of what happened to those shares you bought in the month of March in 2009 at the bottom of the market when the S&P hit 666. Well, today it's over 2,000. So instead of fear taking over, you're ignoring the end game. In other words, you know, if you're in your 40s or 30s, you know, there's 20, 30 years away before you're going to retire. You're not going to be thinking about whatever the market is worrying about today. You will have forgotten about that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, or 20 years from now. And so this is the time of your life you can afford to ride out the market. And you have to think of what this is doing for you. When the stock market goes down, the money you're putting in the market are buying you more shares of that mutual fund than it did when the market was going up. So you're buying more shares. And the only thing you really care about when you retire, how many shares do you own? Not what the market is doing. It's accumulation. And it's something that, like Warren Buffett has often said, they can shut down the market. I could care less. Companies I own, like energy companies, utility companies, food companies, or Coca-Cola, they're going to still make money. I'm not concerned about it. And that's why I think taking a long-term perspective, a lot of times you'll see people that, and especially since coming out of the financial crisis of 2007 and 9, they've moved out of stocks, they've moved into bonds or cash when they've got 20 years of growth in savings ahead of them.
So overspending, bad investment choices, biggest mistakes that people make in their 30s and 40s. Now you move on and you're in your 50s. You're not retired yet, but you're sort of coming into the home stretch here, closer to retirement. What happens to bad choices here?
Yeah, this is a period when some bad choices really, and I'm talking about the bad choices that you made, either overspending, not starting early enough, they start to come home to roost. Because in your 50s, you're not only closer to retirement, but that's when you get hit with the big expenses. Think college education, think weddings for your daughter. And the biggest mistake, John, is too much savings now are allocated towards college. And today, you take a look at the cost of a college education, which has been going up at 8% a year over the last two or three decades. For most people, private college, out-of-state college becomes cost prohibitive. Over $100,000 out-of-state, you're talking about $150,000 to $200,000 for an Ivy League school. So unless you're Larry Lots of Bucks or Marty Millionaire, $150,000 to $200,000 aside for a private education is unrealistic for most parents. And that's why we're in big favor, especially at this time, of a junior college for the first couple of years, state school for the last 2 years is more realistic. Even better, junior stays at home, works, and goes to an online university, which is less costly. It frees up for the parents more savings for retirement at a critical period of time in their life. I mean, the last 10 to 15 years before retirement is the period you want to be salting away as much as you can to accumulate assets. And especially in today's environment with low interest rates, it takes more money to retire because money buys less. And if putting the majority of savings towards education and weddings, you're not going to have the assets at retirement. And the last mistake also, John, is same mistake made in the 40s, poor investment choices.
You know, it's interesting you talk about poor investment choices because I often talk about the context of people I run into at the gym when we start talking about investments. And I've been talking to this one gentleman for ever since the stock market crashed. As a matter of fact, he's now retirement. He has a considerable amount of money, but he's always asking me, where should you put your money? And I tell him, well, you know, the stock market's been a bull market. And of course, he did exactly what you said over the first 5 years following me, to sit there with his knees knocking, going, oh yeah, but the market could collapse again, you know. And just a couple of weeks ago, he was telling me, he says, well, I'm diversifying. I've got some in the stock market, but I've got a bunch over here in bonds and this and that. And I'm saying, well, you realize you're not making any money over in those cash instruments right now. As a matter of fact, you're going backwards because of inflation. He says, yeah, but I sleep better at night, you know. So it's bad choices here. This seems to be the issue that we're facing, is people just keep making bad choices. A lot of it is fear and emotion driven.
Yeah, I think that the investment mistakes made during this period are, you almost have two scenarios. One is, and I've seen this one, and this is really dangerous, is you get to your 50s, you haven't put money aside, you've made some poor investment choices or savings choices, financial choices, whatever they are, and it's kind of like double up. Now I'm going to take some high risk and try to make it up. So I've seen people put a lot of money into one asset class thinking that they can make up for it. We saw a lot of this, John, in the last decade, latter part of the decade, where people loaded up on gold and gold stocks. They thought they were going to get rich when the world ended, and they fell victim to the gloom and doom promoters who were selling fear and greed. They were selling fear. The market was going to collapse. The dollar was going to collapse. But at the same time, they were also selling greed. Hey, all this bad stuff's going to happen, but if you buy gold stocks and gold, you're going to get filthy rich during this period of time. So on the other coin, you have almost the reverse, where you almost get too conservative because of a bear market. You saw people dump stocks and the majority of money, and you can see this with the Lipper fund flows, the vast majority of money has gone into cash and bonds instead of a diversified portfolio. I mean, you know, we've used this illustration in the past. Had you owned Coca-Cola, Exxon, Procter & Gamble, yes, they went down in 2007, 8, and 9, but what happened is during that whole period of time, you were getting 7, 8, and 10% dividend increases. And by the end of 2009, Coke had recovered. Procter & Gamble was up above. And Exxon increased its dividend 10% a year. It is now higher than it was during the financial crisis. And that's why you almost have almost two bad investment choices. Either one, taking on too much risk. The other one is getting too risk adverse instead of a balanced portfolio. You know, you can't always control what the market's going to do, but you can control your exposure to the market and not being overinvested in one asset class, which is what people are tending to do these days.
Okay, let's move on to the 60s. Supposedly, theoretically, you did your homework and had a plan. You should be retired or at least well off heading into retirement at this stage.
You know, the mistakes made here are different, but also there's a common theme similar to the 40s and 50s, which is bad investment choices. But let's start with the big one, and it's related to investments, and that's the failure to plan for medical expenses. There have been studies done by Fidelity and other major institutions. The average couple, let's say age 65 with a lifespan between 25 to 30 years between a husband and wife, will end up spending out of pocket $250,000 for medical expenses. I mean, a serious illness arrives and they're not prepared for it. And during that illness, if they're not prepared, assets can be drawn down, leaving the well spouse in financial straits because you're paying for medical expenses. You may have to pay for, let's say, a retirement home. You might have to pay for expensive drugs. And as we know, with under Obamacare, people are having to pay more and more money for premiums and the government is covering less. So another mistake related to not being prepared for medical expenses is they make no provisions for inflation. There's too much money invested in non-inflation assets like cash and bonds. So when medical issues crop up 10, 15 years later into retirement, they don't have the assets that have been set aside or have grown in terms of asset size or income to pay for these expenses as they come up. So closely related to the not preparing for medical expenses is poor investment choices.
Any final or other mistakes that we haven't covered, especially late-term mistakes?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that because one that we see is not taking the spouse into the investment decisions or financial decisions. Oftentimes, John, we see couples, you know, where let's say the husband makes the financial decisions. What happens? He gets ill and passes on. The surviving spouse, the children, the heirs of the estate don't know where the assets are, or worse, were not taken into consideration when making those investment choices or not educated to them, and they fall victim to, number one, investment scams, poor investment choices, and being uninformed, and they're not protected. I see a lot of estate plans today where we see spousal abuse. We're seeing spouses who were not part of investment choices all of a sudden now faced with bills and making investment choices unprepared for it. So not making both husband and wife equally involved in the investment decisions, knowing where the investments are, how those investment decisions are. And quite honestly, sometimes when both the husband and wife are both engaged, better investment decisions are made. Maybe one spouse tempers the proclivity of the other spouse to go in one direction. So there maybe is more balance because they may have different attitudes about risk and investing. But you never want to leave one spouse totally ignorant of financial affairs or your heirs as well.
Well, now that we've sort of listed these lessons about not making mistakes, let's look at some case studies. Normally, we take one case study. What we're going to do here is take multiple case studies, very short, and show how the different planning features and principles you've outlined here during decades of lifetime have end results.
You know, one of the cases we've shared on this program, it's one of my favorite cases, Matt and Deborah Stein. And this was a case where we're on to the third generation of planning. Now, I started out with Matt's dad, did a financial plan, estate plan. That's how I got introduced to Matt. And his father introduced me to him, and he was in a medical practice. And what we did is we set up a financial plan. We prioritized our goals from bar mitzvahs to weddings to college education and retirement. And because retirement was the ultimate end goal, Matt's medical practice had a pension plan. So in the early years, he was putting money aside in a pension. And because he started earlier, he had the $1 million that he wanted to have when he retired. In fact, he had $2.5 million when he retired, and today it's over $4 million. But one thing that he did, because planning worked so well, not only with his father, but it also worked with him in terms of his financial goals, he also started his kids. So he had basically two daughters and a son, and we worked with two of the children. We're hopefully going to get the third one to start doing some planning. But one of his daughters married a geologist that works for a major oil company. And because major oil companies are international, he has spent a lot of his time. First, he started out in the States in Houston, and then eventually he moved overseas. But like his father, we started out with a financial plan for them. They wanted to set money aside for a house. They wanted to set money aside for their kids' education because that's what they went through. Their father took care of their college education. So when they graduated, like what Matt's dad did for him in medical school, when you think about a doctor graduating from medical school with no student loans because his father took care of it. So we started with them doing the same thing. And now they're in their late 30s. In the case of his daughter and son-in-law, he is now working overseas. And because you work overseas, there's a special provision in the U.S. tax laws. I think it's like $95,000 is exempt from federal taxes. The oil company is picking up food, picking up his driver, his car expenses, his housing expenses. And so they are just salting away this money because, you know, the first $95,000 of what they make is really not taxed. And so they're putting money aside personally. He's putting money aside in his 401k program. He's putting his bonuses in the deferred comp. So we're not only funding college education, weddings, but their own retirement. And John, here they are, a couple in their late 30s, and they have over $600,000. You know, they're going to be just like their father by the time they get to retirement. They're not going to have $1 million. They're going to have several million dollars. Their college educations will be funded. The weddings will be paid for. And that's, once again, the concept of starting early. They started, when they got married, one of the first things their dad said, you're going to get a financial plan. And that was the first thing we did when they started out with their marriage. We want a plan. Obviously, the first thing they wanted to do is they wanted to have a house and they wanted to start a family. And we've made provisions for that, just like in the case of her father.
Let's move on to a case which involves college planning. And we'll talk about Jim and Kathy Linden here.
You know, this case was sort of critical, and it's one I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to relate to. They were in their 50s, had a daughter, very brilliant daughter. She wasn't valedictorian of her graduating class, but pretty close to it, almost a straight-A student. And she got accepted when she was applying for college to some Ivy League schools, and John, you know what they cost, close to $150,000 to $200,000. One was an out-of-state college and a couple private ones. And their parents had been putting money aside for each one of the grandkids. So they had money in a 529 plan that they had put aside for their kids. But it wasn't enough to fund a private education. Now, here's the key point in this case. If they would have funded, they were thinking of taking a second mortgage on the home to pay for the private education. And here's the thing that just absolutely didn't make sense. She wanted to become a teacher. And, you know, starting salaries here in California for teachers are in the $40,000. So did it make sense to spend $200,000, take out a mortgage on a house to pay for a private education? And this was kind of a tough one. I mean, you know, think about it. If you're listening to this program, every parent would be thrilled to find out they have a brilliant child that gets accepted to one of the top-notch schools in the country. But here's the problem. If you don't have the money, does it make sense to go into debt or to forego all your retirement savings to fund that college education? In this case, one of the hardest, truthful things we had to do is say, you can't afford to do this. And one of the hardest things, but eventually, was explaining to the daughter, look, I know it would be nice to go to this prestigious college, but you know what? This is what it's going to do to your parents if they do this. Do you really want your parents taking out a mortgage on the family home to pay for this and not be able to retire? And here's the reality. Well, you teach. It doesn't make a difference if your degree is from Stanford, Harvard, or let's say San Diego State University. you're not going to get any more pay. Your pay is still going to be $40,000. So in this case, they opted for junior college and a state school, and that took off the pressure because there was almost enough in the 529 plans, especially with junior college, to cover the education expenses, and especially for a child that was going to become a teacher at 40 grand a year.
Okay, let's talk about poor investment choices and making decisions on the basis of fear. We'll look at the Smiths.
In this case, we've talked about this one before, but I'm going to get to the crux of this. The main issue was Bill, when he retired in 2006, his wife was a teacher. She was still working, but he rolled over his 401k program, roughly about $800,000 in 2006, and he put it all into the stock market. After all, housing was booming. The economy was booming. The emerging markets were booming. The stock market was going up, even though Greenspan was raising interest rates. And it looked like a pretty good decision in 2006 until probably the first part of 2007. It was only until the end of 2007 and 2008 and 2009 that the difficulties came, because basically Bill lost a little over 25% of his 401k program. By the time he panicked, got out of the market, that $800,000 had dropped to $600,000, and basically it was kept there mainly in cash for the first 3 years of the market recovery. And what we had to do is explain, look, first of all, he was 10 years older than his wife, Jan. The other thing was he had a heart condition. Jan's family lived to their 90s, so not only do we have an age difference, but we had a health issue that came to play. So what we did, to make a long story short, is we put a laddered bond portfolio together so he was assured he would have his income, and then when the bonds matured, he'd have his principal. But we also had to take part of that $600,000, roughly in this case, I think it was about $150,000, that we put into blue chip stocks, the Coca-Colas, the Johnson & Johnsons, the Procter & Gambles, the Exxons, the Pfizers, the kind of things that make up the Dow type stocks. And I remember, John, when we did this, we had the taper tantrum. Remember that in May of 2013? And this was, what, 2 or 3 months into the stock program, and all of a sudden, we got that 7% correction. And I got the call. He wanted to come and see. And he goes, see, this is what I was worried about. And I said, look, we're still in a bull market. The Fed's injecting liquidity. This is going to be a correction. It's going to come back. Your Coca-Cola dividends aren't going to change. Exxon and all that. None of this is going to change. You're not going to lose income. And the likelihood is every one of these stocks are going to increase the dividend, which is exactly what happened. Stock market came back, and we were up over 30% for the year. Every one of the companies in his portfolio increased their dividends. And so it was through proper allocation, knowing what each investment did in the portfolio, that he was able to ride that out and then have the confidence going through a couple downturns, seeing the stock market come back, seeing that companies increase their dividend, and most importantly to him, that his income wasn't impacted. In fact, it actually grew.
Important thing in planning, which we have thrummed all the time here on the show, and Carol and I do this all the time because we've been working together on radio and TV projects longer than we were married. And so you had to learn how to collaborate and work together and work out disagreements and come up with a common plan and then stick to it. Let's talk about taking into account your spouse and the planning, because if you're trying to do it and your spouse isn't on board with this, there may be constant tension because the spouse doesn't know what the goals are. So let's look at the Henleys here.
In this case, the situation here was, in the Henleys case, Harry made all the financial decisions. He was the main breadwinner. His wife, Catherine, never worked, and even did such nice things by even filling his wife's car with gas. I mean, he really pampered his wife, treated her well, but it was in that situation, John, and this is very much, you saw this with a lot of the late World War II generation, where the husband was the breadwinner, wife stayed at home and raised the kids. And this certainly was the case between Harry and Catherine. And what happened is Harry developed a series of illness, from heart disease, which was the result of diabetes, cancer. And basically, the last 6 years of his life, he was pretty ill. I mean, he fought a brave fight, but at the end, he succumbed to cancer. And the real issues, and we raise this in the plan, is what was going to happen. Because, I mean, Harry paid the bills. He took care, made all the financial decisions. So what we incorporated in the plan, he had an accountant that he had used who had basically a family practice. His son had brought into the practice. And basically, we set it up so that when Harry passed on, the bills and things like that would be paid for and the work would be done by the accounting firm that would take care of that until she was able to write the checks herself, make sure that she had enough money in her account. So it was basically an education process that we began the last 2 years of Harry's life, getting Catherine prepared for the eventuality of Harry passing on, so that she would be able to take care of the checking, the financial decisions. We managed the money. The accountant did the taxes. And basically, taking and bringing her through an education process of learning to balance a checkbook, learning to pay bills. And most of the stuff now is done online. But it was something that we fortunately had enough time to prepare for that we were able to get this taken care of. Cancer is a tough disease to go through. But what it does do, it buys you time compared to, let's say, a sudden death heart attack where you don't have time and you're just taken. So this allowed us to have enough time to take care of his wife, get her educated, bring her up to speed. We also had a successor trustee that came into the trust. So should she have dementia? Also, he wanted to make sure that she was protected against children because he was well aware of elder abuse. A similar friend got into the same situation. So all of these things were taken care of the last couple of years of Harry's life. In the end, it basically protected his wife. She's up to speed and educated, handling the finances. She knows how to read the investment statements. She knows the money that comes in each month. She knows what her income is, knows what her taxes are, and pays her bills. And now she is doing fine on her own.
So the bottom line in all of this is that planning makes good retirement and financial decisions possible. Without it, you're sort of shooting from the hip in many, many cases, and you could wind up with some really disastrous results. Now on to our guest this week is Lowell Smith. He's president of Inspira. He'll be discussing potential pitfalls in SEP, IRA, employer design, and administration. Should be interesting, all part of retirement planning as lifetime income continues here at FinancialSense.com.
Joining me on the program is Lowell Smith. He's president and chief operating officer of Inspira. He has over 30 years of experience in retirement and financial service industry. You know, Lowell, this is that time of the year when Americans get focused on their taxes. We have to file them by April 15th. We also get focused on pensions. One of the ways that people reduce their taxes, especially self-employed, are things like SEP IRAs or SEP plans. So to begin with, since these are two of the most popular plans next to 401ks, let's take a simple IRA and a SEP plan. Explain the difference between the two for our listeners.
Sure. Both a SEP and a simple, the funding vehicle is an IRA, so you would establish a plan at the employer level, and then employees would get money funded into an IRA account that they've established, but the monies are coming directly from the employer. There is a significant difference, though, between a SEP IRA and a simple IRA. The SEP IRA, essentially, you're funding a traditional IRA. And what I mean by a traditional IRA is this is an IRA that is the same type of vehicle that you could set up on your own and put, you know, $5,000 in a year or $6,000. You get an additional limit because it's coming from an employer plan, and it can go up to a significant amount of money, and we'll go into that separately. A simple IRA is where you defer, almost like a 401k plan, you would defer a portion of your income into that IRA, and your employer would then match that amount. The other difference is, in a traditional IRA, or that SEP IRA that's gone into a traditional IRA, I can roll that into other retirement plans. I can roll it into other IRAs. But once it's in a simple IRA, it's actually going to stay in the simple IRA because it's a different type of a vehicle. So there's a little bit of difference in those types of IRAs. They're not really rollable back and forth between each other or into a retirement plan or another IRA from a simple. Now, were you interested in what are the different contribution differences?
Yeah, that would be very important, because aren't there major differences between those two when it comes to contributions?
Correct. To specify, a SEP plan, it doesn't matter how many employees you have, you could have one. Really, the practicality is it only really works for a single employer, a person who has only one employee and it's themselves, or maybe their spouse. A solo K can only be available when you have fewer than 100 employees that make at least $5,000 a year. So not everybody can have a solo K. With a SEP plan, essentially the contribution limit is for that employer, you can contribute into someone's account up to 25% of their income, with a limit of in 2013, and it's not too late to do a SEP for 2013, you could do $51,000. Now, that is assuming you made enough money so that you could do all $51,000. In a simple IRA, the limitation is an individual can put away $12,000 a year, and the employer, through a matching contribution, obviously would match that amount. It would be something less than, obviously, the $51,000 a year. Also, if you were deferring it yourself and you put money in, you would also be able to, if you were over 50, contribute another $2,500 into a simple IRA. So essentially, if you're over 50, your contributions could be as much as $14,500 plus the match, which would be essentially whatever you're making times up to 3%. And whereas the contributions that go into a SEP IRA are really based on what that earnings are that year and how much, what percentage of those you want to put into the SEP account.
So basically, the SEP plan allows for a higher contribution, as you mentioned, 25% of salary and $51,000. All plans require documentation, and documentation has to be updated. There are rules, things that you have to comply with. Let's talk about some of the problems you run into SEP plans. For example, you haven't updated your SEP plan document for the current law. How do you fix that?
Well, mostly you would go back to your provider. Usually there are two methods in order to adopt a SEP. You can do a 5305, which is a form that you can get from the IRS that you would just fill out and update your SEP. A lot of the providers of the investments that you might be investing in or the IRAs that you're investing in will have their own SEP document, which you could also use to update. Now, usually just prototypes where you fill in the name of your company, the tax ID, and you elect if you want to exclude anybody from eligibility. There are some people you can exclude from eligibility in a SEP and a simple. Actually, the rules are fairly similar. So you would update that document. In addition to that document, and on the simple side, it's the same thing. The simple side is a little bit more complicated in the sense that, yes, you have the 5305-simple that people can fill in, but there is also prototypes available by providers. A lot of the providers, though, if they have a prototype, will restrict you to initially making contributions into IRAs established under their brand, essentially under their custody. So in some plans, if you don't have that, if you had a simple, people could actually open up IRAs anywhere they wanted to, but the employer would then have to try to figure out how to get money to all those other IRAs. Most people, in a practicality sense, open up a document with a provider of the assets and have at least the initial contributions all going to that provider. And it makes it a lot easier from an initial data transmission and money transmission process. But then again, if a person doesn't want that, they can always transfer that to another IRA with a different provider. But a lot of times, that's part of that document process. The updates that come out periodically, there hasn't been a major update, frankly, in a SEP or simple document that required you to go out and re-sign up in the last 10 years. But there have been some law changes that did affect them. So what you're supposed to be using is when you sign up new account holders, you're supposed to use the new documents. And those are the new individual account holders, but they haven't really affected to any great degree the existing SEPs and existing simple plan documents. So again, there's a plan document, then there's an individual account holder IRA document that needs to be completed.
completed.
Well, I mean, the whole idea behind these, as they're described, SEP, Simple Employee Pension Plan, Simple IRA, they were put into place to make it easier or to encourage people or employers to do this without all the complications you get into, for example, a defined benefit pension plan, 401k plans, things like profit sharing, defined contribution plans, and all the variations of those plans, deferred comp. So has that pretty much been in place? As you mentioned, they haven't made too many changes, because I know in some of the other plans, whether it's 401ks or defined benefit, they're always making changes.
They do. They make a lot more changes in those areas. The changes that have come up in the SEP and the Simple have actually been on the IRA side, on the actual individual IRA. And a lot of those were waivers of distribution penalties based on some laws. They haven't really changed the plan design in years. I don't know the last time I can even remember that happening. 401k plans, the last thing they had was the Pension Protection Act. And in that case, all the documents, as a matter of fact, they're starting all the amendment processes for what we call qualified plans. Those are your 401ks, your defined benefit plans. They're now having to amend all their documents. It's actually an expensive process. In that case, if you would amend a document, it could cost you, you know, hundreds to thousands of dollars as an employer to amend that document, whereas amending a simple and a solo K is just filling out a new prototype. And usually, again, if you go through a provider or even use the government form, there's no cost at all.
So what are some of the other complications that can arise from these plans? I mean, you have employees, you have employer contributions, depending on the plan. You have employees that are eligible, those are not. Can you get into some of the details on that?
Sure. When you go to a SEP IRA, you can exclude, it's a little different exclusion on the simple, but I'll go over that also. You can exclude individuals who are under 21. And who have not earned at least $550 annually for that employer in 3 out of the last 5 years. So if you wanted to exclude people who haven't worked there at least 3 out of the last 5 years, you can. And you can also usually exclude non-resident aliens from those plans, people who are in the United States who can work here, but they're not residents of the United States. So those are people you can exclude. Very similar exclusions in the simple world, although they use a $5,000 rule in a simple world. You don't have to include people who've made under $5,000 for participation in that plan. So those are things that can get you in trouble. For example, let's say you don't follow that rule. You know, if you're ever audited, you might have that problem. Again, the problem is not that much in SEPs, because if you think about it, the people who do SEPs are usually trying to do a SEP to maximize the amount they're putting away. And if they're doing a SEP and they have employees, they have to give the employees the exact same percentage contribution unless they do a special document, which they can do, a specialized document, but they may have age weighting on it or something like that. But even with that, it doesn't really reduce that much how much they would have to contribute to other individuals. But so if they want to do their $51,000 last year, they would have to put away 25% of their salary. They'd have to give all their other employees 25% of their salary. So it gets expensive if you have multiple employees. And actually, when a lot of companies start out with a SEP, and once they get employees, they switch because they just don't want to make that contribution for everybody who's working for them, because it does get fairly expensive. The simples are something they then go to where there's like a match and also the ability for that employee to contribute to the plan. Again, in the simple, you also, if you're over 50, you can make an additional contribution of $2,500 a year. Similar to in a 401k plan, it's actually $5,500. It's a little higher limits in qualified plans. With another type of a small business plan, you could actually put away even more than the $51,000 a year in a qualified plan, but there are administrative costs. With a SEP and a simple, there are very limited administrative costs. Sometimes there's no cost to the employer. In some cases, it may be a couple $100 a year for someone to keep the records, but it's not an expensive expense. Whereas if you went to a, for these small employers, and you went to like a 401k plan, for example, or you went to a defined benefit plan, which would even be more expensive, you know, the administrative fees can go as high as, you know, they could start at $1,500 as a base and $30 to $60 an employee as a cost. And that's usually a cost you could push off to the employees, but most employers pay that themselves.
Well, something that I think is very important for our listeners to understand is the 2013 tax year is over, but you can put into place these plans prior to filing your taxes. I wonder if you can address that, number one. And number two, given the tax increases that were put into place last year affecting single individuals and married couples that could push them into the higher Obama tax rates versus the Bush tax rates, if you're on the borderline of going into those higher Bush tax rates, seems like the SEP plan and the contribution could really help an individual out and keep them in that lower tax bracket.
Oh, absolutely. I think as you're going there, and a lot of people establish now a simple plan, you have to establish by October 1st of the prior year. So you can't now go back and establish a simple IRA plan for 2013. It's too late. Nor could you do a qualified plan, 401k or DB. But you could do a SEP. So SEP has the same date of April 15th or the filing date in order to establish one and fund one as any IRA would have. So you can always push that back to the previous year. But that is a good method, obviously, with the additional taxes that you're seeing on, especially on high income individuals. That is a good way to defer some of that money and lower their taxes, particularly in this day and age. As you go into that, one other thing that I haven't mentioned is that, and a lot of your listeners probably have Roth IRAs or would like to have a Roth IRA, have a Roth 401k. In these SEPs and simple IRAs, you cannot have a Roth provision. So all the money is always tax deferred, you know, pre-tax in these things, and then the growth is tax deferred.
So right now, for our listeners, if they're kind of scrambling, and you know, a lot of people here, Lowell, in 2012 were kind of shocked by the increase in taxes put into place and made retroactive by the state of California. Last year, Obama in Congress changed the tax rate. So maybe a lot of people just weren't aware of it, and they're maybe seeing their accountant now and getting a shock. If they're self-employed, basically what you're saying here, it's still not too late to put in a SEP plan.
Correct. It's not too late to put in a SEP plan. Now, you can't have another type of plan. But if you don't have any plan at all, it's not too late to put in a SEP plan for 2013.
Not a bad idea when you take a look at somebody that could be pushed into those higher Bush tax rates over 40%. And here in California, where you can get up into the 11, 12, and 13% bracket, when you think about it, Lowell, the government is basically funding half your plan through tax savings.
Correct. And if you look at it, a lot of these people are self-employed, and they are also paying their share of the Social Security and Medicare taxes, too. So there's a lot of taxes that are already hitting those individuals. If they can reduce that tax burden, obviously that's better for them. Plus, it helps them save for retirement. So it's a double win for them.
So when we talk about, once again, these plans, they haven't changed that much. They were put into place to encourage employers or self-employed individuals to save for their retirement. The government wanted to make them simple versus all the complicated plans and administrative costs that go into things like 401ks, defined benefits that we talked about. So when you are advising, let's say, a self-employed individual, what are the parameters that you use to decide, well, maybe you're better off with a simple IRA or you're better off with a SEP plan? Or do you advise that there are other plans that may be even more appropriate?
Well, in our firm, we don't actually do the advice, but we work with advisors and we help them. I think the difference, obviously, is if you've got a SEP, again, unless it's a company like a professional corporation or something like that, you only want to have one employee because, again, there's that amount that you're going to have to contribute. If you don't care about that, it's not a bad plan because everybody can max out their contribution for the year and get that put away. If you have employees, but you also, maybe you're small, you're looking to start something up, maybe grow, maybe you want to go at some point to get into a qualified plan, a simple IRA works well because it looks a lot like a 401k plan, but it doesn't cost you very much. Not only is it just the cost, when I have a qualified plan, as they call it, which is like a 401k and a defined benefit plan, there's a lot of things I have to do that I do not have to do in the IRA funded plans. Number one is there are fiduciary standards I have to follow. I have to have investment policy statements. I have to limit investments that are made available to the individuals. I got to monitor the plan. I've got to make sure that I'm following all the Department of Labor steps. I got to issue summary plan descriptions to every employee. I got to update that whenever I made changes to the plan. I've got to essentially have quarterly trustee meetings to go over the plan and the investments that are in there and make changes if I want to. None of those things do you have to do in a SEP or a simple, at least not at this time. So it's not just the initial cost. It's do you have the ability as a company to take on the additional burden that's involved in doing what would be a qualified plan. Again, in a simple IRA, the only real burden is that you're going to send money to an IRA account for that individual to invest. In a SEP, it's the same thing. So it's not a whole lot of administrative burden. There is one thing you do have to do in a simple IRA that you don't have to do in the SEP. Actually, you can change. I hadn't mentioned this earlier. An employer can change their contributions each year, because the rule for a simple says you either have to match 3%, or you could do a non-elective contribution of 2% to everybody, whether they contribute or not. Or in 2 out of 5 years, I can lower my contribution amount from that 2% non-elective or 3% match to 1%. So because of those rules, most people don't change it. If they do the 3%, they usually stick with it. But because they can do that change, starting in November every year, they have to give notice to employees of what they're going to contribute next year. That's the only thing administratively you have to do with a simple. Again, so there's a lot less administrative work in there. And, you know, the investments that are available for those plans are pretty much the same types of investments that are available with qualified plans. There are some differences.
And when you look at this, is there any pitfalls or drawbacks to either of these plans?
Well, I think there are a couple of drawbacks, too. Is if you want to use this as a way to encourage your employees to stay with your company for a period of time, you can't put in what are called vesting schedules, which say for the amount that I am contributing for you, in a SEP it would be all your money. In a simple IRA, it would be the amount that you match. I could make you, in order to get all that money when you leave employment, you have to stay a certain number of years. They call that vesting. You can't do that in these types of plans. So that is one other downfall. The other downfall, if you're trying to look out for your employees, and this happens a lot in the ones that we administer, is that you'll make a contribution into somebody's account and they'll withdraw it the next day. Because in a retirement plan, a qualified plan, you have to have a termination event to get to your money or take a loan or a hardship withdrawal. Those aren't available in these types of plans, because so you can't have loans, you can't have hardships. But you don't need them, because the people can just take the money right out of their IRA account. Now, they'd probably pay a penalty if they're under 59 and a half. The penalty in a simple is if you take money within 2 years of establishment, that penalty can be as much as 25% of the distribution. But again, some of the downfalls is individuals can actually get to those. The other downfall is because these are individual IRAs that are being established, in some instances, depending on how much money would go into these accounts, the cost of the investment may be higher than you get in a qualified plan. And what I mean by that is, if I have a couple million, $3-4 million in a 401k plan for my employees, I may be able to have access to share classes of funds or investments at a lower cost than someone who might go in and buy a retail share class that might have a load or something of that nature. The other difference is a lot of common and collective trust funds are used in large retirement plans, 401k plans, and they're not even that large. They could be a million or two in the plan. Those collective trusts usually have lower expense ratios. The idea is they look like a mutual fund, but they're kind of managed outside of the mutual fund arena and aren't 12B1 fees, which are essentially commissions paid to a distribution channel. There's not a lot of those other fees. So the cost of the investment's less. So the theory is that the investment would perform better. Those are not available in SEPs or simple IRAs.
You know, one of the things that surprised a lot of people, and this was mentioned last year in a speech that the president gave, where he suggested that there would be a complete limitation on an individual's retirement plan of $3 million collectively, all retirement plans, whether it was Roth, IRAs, SEPs, whatever it is. Do you see that eventually coming into place? And if it is, it seems like that would rule out putting in the higher plans that allow for larger contributions, and especially over a period of time where they can accumulate and become quite significant.
Yeah, you know, we've looked at that. You know, obviously, the retirement industry has been fighting against that, obviously, for a number of reasons. It has some legs. It hasn't really gone very far in Congress right now, but you never know. It depends on what administration's in at the time as to how far that would go. If that were to occur, then yeah, you would probably have plans that once they got to a certain amount, the owner would stop contributing to the plan and probably start contributing to essentially taxable investment options. And you also get to a point, if you think about it from the tax rates that you have now, those people who are fairly well off, who are making contributions into plans, SEPs, simples, IRAs, 401ks, whatever those may be, since the distributions from those, other than a Roth, are taxed at normal income tax rates, you may be better off in some instances to not contribute to your retirement plan and to go into investments that would be taxed at capital gains rates, which are significantly less than the top rate of income tax.
So given this, and this does, since they approach the subject, the only reason I'm bringing this up, Lowell, is I have seen over the years, and of course, you've been in the business, you've seen this, how they have changed the contribution rules, the limitations, the taxation of overfunding for things like defined benefit pension plans. Boy, they play around with those things more than I ever see. Could there be unintended consequences? Like when they started doing that to defined benefit pension plans, you saw them being used less, especially by the major corporations, where, you know, I can think back 30, 40, 50 years ago, they were very common. So an individual could go work for General Motors or some company, come out and figure that they were going to get a pension, much like government workers do. But when you change the laws constantly, change the rules, make it more difficult to file, in some sense, there are unintended consequences. You discourage it.
They've been fiddling with those type of rules for so long that it has discouraged defined benefit plans, particularly, are almost non-existent in corporate America, where they tend to be used because they still can work, because they're so expensive to administer is one of the reasons. Also, some of the contribution rules is they're often used in smaller companies as more of estate planning tools, because you could actually have a 401k and a defined benefit plan, and those people are willing to kind of fiddle with it because all the money in there is going to be for a small group of usually highly comped or owners that use defined benefit plans. But the other thing they've added a lot of complication. Now there's fee disclosure on retirement plans and defined contribution plans where, you know, everywhere you have to tell all the employees what they paid, all the providers have to tell specifically to the employers what they're paying for, which is not a bad idea. It's just adding more costs. So what they're doing is they're trying to protect a lot of times the account holder, but they're adding so much cost to it that the employers are just saying, this is just too much trouble. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'll go to something that's a little easier. Problem is, the only thing that's really any easier right now is the SEPs and the simples.
Yeah, because I've seen this, because we deal with a lot of private owners of their own business. And I have seen over the years where some of them just said, you know what, this is just getting too complicated. I've even seen some of them just say, you know what, it's not worth the hassle. By the time I have to contribute to all my employees, by the time I pay the administration costs, by the time I pay for the compliance costs, do everything that I'm required to do, I'm almost paying as much for administration and everything else as I'm getting a benefit for myself. So I've seen one employer that basically says, look, I'm going to give you a bonus at the end of the year. You do with it whatever you want. Set up your own IRA. But they basically cut out their pension plan because of all the administrative costs and all the hassles of dealing with these plans.
And I think you're seeing a lot of that. Obviously, it's unintended consequence because they obviously would like people to have plans for individuals. But if they keep making it more and more complicated to do business and do these plans, you're going to have fewer employees putting meaningful programs into place. But again, they always have a place to go as long as they're small. They could do the simple IRAs if they're under 100. Not too many of those companies that are going to do SEPs unless they're just individual employees of that company, sole proprietors.
Well, listen, Lowell, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the services you provide, how could they do so, please?
You can always go to www.inspirafs.com and learn about the services we provide. Essentially, we provide these services to others. We don't actually sell directly any services. What we're doing is we work for other companies. We private label, we white label IRA solutions for others, advisors, banks, record keepers of 401k plans. That's kind of our core business.
Well, listen, Lowell, thanks for joining us on the program.
Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Well, that concludes this week's edition of Lifetime Income. We have a lot of issues we're going to be covering going forward this year, things dealing with estate, planning for retirement, issues with Medicare, also with Social Security, planning for retirement, and also education. So I hope you'll stay tuned, and we hope that through this process, we can help you start making better decisions. I don't care if you're a young couple starting out in your 30s, 40s, in your 50s, or maybe into retirement itself. In the meantime, well, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.